In a news environment that's become very he said, she said, have journalists forgotten that part of their job is to point out when a politician is actually lying? Join David Korn, chief of the Washington Bureau for Mother Jones Magazine, and Carrie Nordland of the Watson Institute as they explore what it's like to cover truth and lies during the Trump presidency, especially in light of the recent controversy over President Trump's handling of offering condolences to military families.
So David, diving into today's news. So we heard this morning from Mrs. Johnson, the widow of one of the fallen soldiers from Niger. So two questions around this. Number one, what are you hearing about what happened in Niger?
There's still a fair amount of ambiguity or question. There's still a number of questions about what the mission was, what they were doing. I mean, I think basically 99.9% of Americans did not have any idea that we had troops, let alone special forces, in Niger. But we also have them in, I don't know, over 120, 130 countries now, all part of the war on terror. And I'm sure they're all working very hard and they're, you know, making sacrifices for us. But it's really not part of the public discussion about where they are, what they're doing, and if this is the most effective way to confront the challenge in front of us. So while this is a tremendously tragic event, you know, for the loss of our countrymen, I'm hoping that it also leads to a broader conversation about our policies and what we're doing. In fact, I was even talking to some Pentagon correspondents just yesterday who are still trying to put together the accounts. And there are different accounts from the Niger government and from the U.S. government and from inside the American military about what they were doing and what's to blame for the loss of life. So I think that's going to take a while to sort of sort that out and to what degree the mistakes were egregious or mistakes that could have been avoided. Obviously, there were mistakes made, but obviously, too, in a situation like this, in a conflict-ridden area, there's going to be violence and there are going to be events and loss of life. But the big question is what here was avoidable. It's interesting, they were in a 12-person team. And often how special forces work, particularly when they're in more isolated environments. And the ethos of these teams is often that they are independent. They can do what they can take care of themselves, so to speak. And one question might be, to what degree do they need more outside support?
So it sounds like Jack Reed, John McCain, senators sitting on the Foreign Relations Committee were not briefed on why the soldiers were there. Do you think this will prompt, if Congress can get themselves together, a review of the authorized use of military force?
Well, you know, they probably weren't briefed on special forces operations in 120 other countries as well. Any one of them probably where things like this, you know, could have happened and operations gone bad. So, it's in some ways, I think, quite disturbing for any of us citizens out here to see that members of the Foreign Relations or Armed Services Committee in the Senate and the House are not up to speed on what's happening. I mean, the system is pretty basic. That is the executive branch, which oversees the military, is allowed to do things in secret.
Yep.
Without publicizing it to the world, because that might make it harder to achieve what you want to achieve. But they're allowed to do this because another branch of government, the legislative branch representing us ignorant citizens, oversees these actions. And they can, so it's basically another set of eyes. Okay, where are we, you know, is it worth the funding? Is this right? Is this wrong? Is it effective? And so if we have this wide range of special operations forces and military actions around the world that are not really being vetted by Congress, then, you know, the system isn't doing as it's supposed to be doing, and we don't have representative government.
So let's talk about one of the other issues coming out of this, and this is the phone call that the president had with the widow. And the larger question that I'd like to ask you is, the White House not backing down from their account. And I think the president tweeted this morning again about the phone call. What does this tell you about this White House? Is this symptomatic of this larger issue in the Trump administration? And what is maybe that larger issue within the Trump administration?
Well, the larger issue is the pathos of Donald Trump. And, you know, you say that and it sounds hyperbolic, sounds like you're being overly partisan and so on. But, you know, he has demonstrated time and time again that he puts his own personal interest, even his own personal feelings, ahead of the obvious better road to take.
Mm-hmm.
Before the election, I did a story. I went back and I looked at videos of all, not of all, but of many of the lectures he gave at the Learning Annex and at these success seminars where people pay $150 to hear Donald Trump and other businessmen tell you how to become rich and famous like them.
Mm-hmm.
And these are big auditorium, you know, events and big halls. And one of the things that struck out to me again and again is that he had this riff that he always used, and he often said at the beginning of his lecture or his address, calling it a lecture is almost giving it too much credit. He would say, I'm going to tell you something that they don't teach you at Wharton or at Harvard.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to tell you, this is my number one rule of business, okay? And that they don't teach you this, but this, I'm going to tell you this, and you better remember this. That is, if somebody screws you, you got to screw them back. But not just screw them back. You got to screw them back 10 times over or 15 times over. He said this over and over again to people. It really seems to be his outlook on life. That if someone attacks you or criticizes you, or you perceive they criticize you, not only do you have to counterpunch, you have to pulverize them. You have to annihilate them.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't even matter if it's a POW, in the case of John McCain. It doesn't matter if it's a gold star family like Kaiser Khan's family at the convention. And it doesn't matter now if it's the widow of Sergeant David Johnson. You know, his whole view of the world is you got to destroy your enemies or perceived enemies, perceived critics, you know, in such a fashion. I mean, all of us in Washington this week, and I was at a fancy Washington book party on Saturday night with the, you know, with the media elite.
I was going to say coastal elites.
And we all kind of are scratching our heads because to live in Washington now is like, you can't turn off your outrage and your shock button, but you kind of need to because every day is like Groundhog Day with Trump. It's like, didn't we live through this yesterday? You know, and because the obvious play here for any decent human being, let alone any political leader who just wants to do what's right politically, is to come out and say, I don't get into a tit for tat over this. I don't want to have a, you know, this has been derailed. If I said anything that offended the widow, I'm going to call up and apologize. What I meant to say was this. If it came across the wrong way, you know, the last thing I want to do is cause her an ounce of trouble. And if there are Congress people out there attacking me, I'm not going to address it. Because the one thing we should care about now is, you know, the family and friends of the fallen and to make sure that others don't end up in the same position. And I'm going to be, you know, I'm going to be the leader. Leaders lead. That means they look at what's best for the community that they're in charge of and make decisions based on that. Donald Trump seems completely incapable of thinking in those terms. And even worse, he seems incapable of even being guided by others to think in those terms. I mean, I can, you know, I've sat in meetings with politicians, and I know I have a lot of friends who do this, you know, as a profession, and say, listen, we know you don't want to do this, but this is what you got to do now.
Well, and I was just thinking, as you were saying, that the qualities that, one of the qualities that he prioritizes almost above all is loyalty, so that for even for his staff to suggest this may be seen as disrespect in some way.
Well, one of the sad moments of last week was watching John Kelly, White House Chief of Staff, retired general, who lost his son himself in the military. So he's a Gold Star family member. And he came out, and rather than trying to, you know, bring a resolution to this and talk about how to stop the breach and heal, he came out and he continued to attack Congresswoman Wilson, and did so by lying, or at least giving an inaccurate, a false description of something she had done at an unveiling ceremony for an FBI building. It was ridiculous. This is 100,000,000,000% besides the point.
If he would have stopped at his personal account, which was just gripping and heartbreaking, but then it seemed like he was given political talking points.
Yes, he had to go out and do Donald Trump's bidding. He had to destroy the enemy, pulverize, annihilate the critic, and thus continue the politicization of this tragedy. And he did so by saying something that was completely untrue. And then the issue became, well, is he going to admit that he was wrong or apologize for, falsely accusing her of being a showboat? And he wouldn't, because if he were to do that, that would to Donald Trump be the biggest sign of weakness. Donald Trump has been asked in many interviews, is there anything you regret? Have you ever had to say you're sorry? And he goes, I don't think so. I mean, I think, again, he is not capable of feeling regret.
Not one, no, nothing in his voice or change of tone.
I mean, even when the Access Hollywood tape of him talking about grabbing women by their private parts and basically boasting about committing sexual assault, when he gave a statement that night, he looked like, we in the media refer to it as the hostage tape video, because he's there like reading off a teleprompter and just saying, he doesn't really say, I'm not sure he apologizes or not, I don't really know, but he kind of says, this is locker room talk. I love women, I respect women. But you could tell that like it took, the most mightiest force in the planet to twist his arms to get him to even say that. When he's spoken in the past about apologizing, he's always said that he doesn't think he has anything to apologize for. There's no way that John Kelly now can come out and apologize. There is a sort of mob-like cult that Donald Trump insists on. And, often in criminal gangs, they force, the newbies to commit an act of violence to show that they'll do what you want. Sometimes it's killing a random person. Sometimes it's, doing something else.
Personal sacrifice.
That's how you prove you're loyal. And also, and it seems like Donald Trump insists on the people around him going out there and saying things that are not true, continuing a obscene politicization of an event, to show that they're loyal to him and that they're part of the gang. I mean, this has happened on day one. Yeah. I know I'm long-winded here with Sean Spicer insisting it was the biggest inauguration audience ever. Yep. Jesus couldn't have brought more people out to the lawn that day.
Agree or disagree with former President Carter's assessment that the media has been tougher on President Trump than any other recent president?
Well, I think you have to speak about before and after the election.
Okay.
Before the election, no. I think Trump largely got a free ride because much of the media was covering him as spectacle in a horse race, as a celebrity, and they were giving lots of airtime to without the annotations and the vetting that was necessary. I have to brag a little bit about Mother Jones. We did lots of stories about how he lied about his ties to the mob, financial conflicts of interest with foreign banks, overseas deals that were problematic, that nobody else did at the time. And I've even had some people at other major media outlets come up to me in the time since and saying, what you guys did before the election was great and really prodded us to make sure to look at this. Mainly it was after the election. And so I think before the election, he was not vetted. His scandals were not treated the same way as Hillary Clinton's email server problem. And it was a problem. Mm-hmm. It was a story, but it wasn't the biggest story. And but since the election, I think in a lot of ways he has generated tough media coverage that is completely warranted. I mean, finally, I mean, I've been saying for, I hate to say this because it makes me sound like an old codger, but for decades that one responsibility of the media should be to say when politicians are lying and not, you know, just put everything into a he said, she said, or he said context. And I think that's really an important job of being a reporter. And it was finally towards the end of the campaign, and certainly since the election, where folks, you know, outfits like the New York Times and Washington Post and others are getting out there and saying what the president said today was a lie.
Mm-hmm.
He knew better. He was told otherwise. He still said it. A couple months ago, the New York Times listed all Donald Trump's lies to date. That was their word.
Mm-hmm.
They put a list of 200 or so lies. At that time, the Washington Post has kept a list of his factual inaccuracies. I think they're well over 1,000 now, just since he was inaugurated. So I think, you know, that type of coverage, which is tough, is warranted because he... You know, he pushes the envelope more than anyone else. I.F. Stone, a great columnist, Izzy Stone, worked at The Nation magazine and other places in the 40s, 50s, and 60s at his own newsletter, had a line, all governments lie.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true. Mm-hmm. They all lie. Mm-hmm. But some lie a lot more and about much more important things than others. And I think, you know, Trump has really, you know, raised the bar tremendously on this front and has forced... major media outlets, mainstream media, if you want to call them that, that don't like to be evaluative, don't like to, you know, say that something is a lie. They'd rather put it in a more gentle way. But it's really forced them to confront the president's inaccuracies and the statements in a much tougher way because they are just so excessive.
To your point about people's outrage meters and that we feel sort of on a daily basis there's something new to be outraged about and stunned that something is happening. In that vein of thinking, what are the similarities that you're finding between covering this White House and the Obama or Bush White House?
Well, you know, George W. Bush is in high regard these days because he's, you know, he gave a speech and saying that, you know, basically accusing Trump of trafficking in bigotry and conspiracy theories and divisiveness. And he was completely right about this. And I wish he had been that open on this during the campaign. I think the Republican Party is really to blame for Trump because they've, you know, they keep enabling him. Even those that are on his side, many of them are still not being as critical as they ought to be. But, you know, when I hear George W. Bush speak that way, I did a book called The Lies of George W. Bush, but more importantly, I did a book called Hubris with Michael Isikoff that was about the run-up to the war in which we went behind the scenes and reported out how the Bush administration, Dick Cheney, basically peddled one false assertion after another to bring the country into a war that has led to, you know, 4 million Iraqis displaced, maybe over 1 million Iraqi civilians killed in one way or the other, premature deaths, and of course the deaths of tens of thousands of Americans. And that's really almost as bad as he can go as a president. So, you know, up against Trump, he looks better, at least as a person.
Yeah.
And, you know, and at least he abided by some of the norms of civilized political life. But at the time, it was very, very difficult to cover the run-up to the war in 2002, 2003, right after 9/11. A lot of reporters wanted to give the Bush administration the benefit of the doubt. And I was one of the handful of reporters who was trying to be skeptical and find reasons, you know, find holes in their argument and say, listen, there are other, you know, and look at other alternatives to a full-scale invasion. These days, most of the media is indeed highly skeptical of anything Trump says or does. And there's, you know, been a pretty good amount of good coverage of all the various policy things and what's going on certainly inside the White House. And that's why Donald Trump is bent on, you know, this fake news campaign of his. You know, he wants you know, the third of the public that's still with him to not listen to the rest of the media, because what's coming out there is negative because it's accurate.
So in our closing minutes, I'm going to take this, since we're sitting here in Providence, and we're sitting here on campus and as an alum.
Go Brown.
what lessons do you take from your undergraduate career? You started at the Brown Daily Herald.
Yeah.
Is there any lessons or memory you have that still stays with you?
As much as I want to tout the wonderful academics that I engaged in when I was at Brown, really to me, probably the most formative experience was I worked for the Brown Daily Herald, but I worked for an alternative weekly, too, that went out throughout the state back in those days that doesn't exist anymore. But I covered Buddy Cianci.
Ah.
I knew Buddy well. He offered me a job once, which was a good way to get me off his back.
Yeah.
And I saw what it was like to cover a fellow who was pretty corrupt, very corrupt, but also very popular. And knew how to be a demagogue. Now, he was an effective demagogue in some ways and did get some things done, which is more than I can say for Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he wasn't a hate-driven person. He could be very hateful, and of course, you know, he went to jail for being violent and corrupt. But covering him, and there weren't, you know, the press pool in Rhode Island was not very big, and so I got to play a larger role than I would have had I gone to school elsewhere, a bigger state. But that really taught me a lot about political journalism, and in retrospect now, it taught me a lot about how to deal with a big political figure.
Right. Well, thank you, David, so much for your time.
It's great to talk to you.
This has been Trending Globally, Politics and Policy. If you enjoyed today's conversation, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Stitcher, or download us on your favorite podcasting app. If you like us, rate us, and help others who might enjoy the show find us. For more information, go to watson.brown.edu.